Hello and welcome to yet another edition of the Man Reimagined podcast with myself, Richard Ayling, and as ever now, my good friend, Malcolm Nichols. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good evening, Rich. I am doing remarkably well considering how late in the evening it is over here. Lovely to be back doing another podcast with you, mate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still in my pajamas on this side of the world, so the
I'm
sacrifices we
in.
make.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in my pajamas, just at bedtime pajamas. You're in your morning pajamas.
So without further ado, now that we've given our listeners a sense of, what we're wearing, let's dive into today's topic. Like basically it stemmed from a conversation that you and I had when I was on the way to the airport about a week ago, and we had a brief catch up, and you just come out of, and I don't know much about it, a kind of a rites of passage retreat or experience that was very kind of Maori led, so over in New Zealand, and the energy coming out of you was just like wow, and you had so much to share. And of course, a taxi conversation wasn't ideal, and it just seemed like perfect fodder for this podcast. This concept of rites of passage is something that men and women, historically in kind of indigenous cultures, often went through, sort of the process of becoming like a child to an adult. There's all kinds of rites of passages out there, perhaps, so we could consider a wedding one. So without me kind of blathering on about it, because it's not my area of expertise or experience, especially in this context, I thought I would just kind of start afresh here and say, okay, we bottled that energy up that you had, Mal, and you made some notes, and we're just going to kind of dive into it. I'm coming into this kind of blind and really curious about your experience. So kind of over to you to frame it as you will and share some of that enthusiasm with the listeners about your experience.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. Well, I mean, it was naivety that you were talking about, or not knowing as much is exactly my own personal experience. When I went into and signed up to go and attend this rites of passage retreat in New Zealand, it was a what they would call a kaupapa Maori retreat, which means that it was coming from the Maori perspective. So, as you said, rites of passage is a process, right, of moving from one stage to another, a process of change, at least as I now understand it. But what I thought would be a really good way to start, because it was such an amazing experience, and it was amazing in a number of different ways, but one of them for me was because it gave me an insight and access into a culture that is all around me, i.e. the Maori culture, living in New Zealand, growing up in New Zealand, and yet I knew so little about. But when I went in and experienced this retreat, it was like my eyes opened. It was like I was born again, to not want to put a religious thing in it, but it was as if I kind of started, I still got to see the world in a different way from how I'd previously been seeing it. It was such a profound experience for that. So when I was buzzing on the phone to you, it was because I felt like that's what had happened. I just touched on a culture or a way of viewing the world that was just so profoundly beautiful that I was just fizzing. And so what I'd like to love to do, and as you and I talk, is kind of talk to what I learned about rites of passage. So this idea of transformation that you've mentioned, or moving from one stage of life into another. But also, I want to spend a bit of time kind of talking a bit about in well, Maori, which are the indigenous population in New Zealand, but also just what I got about what we can learn from indigenous cultures, full stop, as a consequence of experiencing this rites of passage.
That sounds like
So,
a Great way to lead us into it. Yeah, and of course I'm going to interject and annoy you and pepper you with questions. And if you know, like if I'm steering you off in a different direction, then you can wheel me back in. But I mean, I'm very curious, and I think people listening to this, I hope they are as well, because you know, that enthusiasm's coming through. And these rites of passage are, I kind of just want to quickly highlight, we've really abandoned them. We've lost them. Did we ever have them? You know, at least in the Western world. So you have a, and I use the word tentatively, like a privileged sort of position to be so close to one still, you know, and yet you've already mentioned it's been kind of alien to you. So there's so much there. I'm really excited to just let you speak, mate. So I'll pipe down and hit, yeah, take me there. Let's go.
Beautiful, mate. And interject whenever you want, mate. But I'll just go. So what I thought would be a great way to start is actually just to give some context around New Zealand, because I think it's really important to kind of understand who Maori are and where they, you know, what where they now sit within the identity of New Zealand, what they've been through, and
Right.
what they're and what they're able to and what they're sharing, what I got to experience as a consequence of going on this retreat. So Maori are that they belong to the group of people who are kind of sit under the umbrella of Polynesians, right? So Polynesians are people who populated a lot of the kind of Eastern Pacific over thousands of years. So they've, you know, got Samoa, Hawaii, Tahiti, the Easter Islands, Tonga, you know, all these. I don't know if you're familiar with these places, but they're actually small little archipelagos that are spread over thousands of kilometers. You know, take for example Tonga. Its main island has got 70,000 people, but you know, it's got hundreds and hundreds of islands that are spread out over thousands of kilometers, right? So the Polynesians are a group of people who are they are massive explorers, and what actually here's something that's really interesting that I only just recently found out is that linguistically they come from Taiwan. So in Taiwan there are four linguistic languages, four separate linguistic languages in Taiwan, and one of them is the group that spawned the Polynesians, which is spread out. I mean, they're the most spread out ethnicity in the on the planet, I think. Just incredible group of people, right? And they would travel. They traveled across these vast stretches of the Pacific Ocean, under but you know sailing by stars and currents and things like that. Like I don't know if you've seen the movie Moana. Most kids in the world rich would have seen Moana, but that's based on all Polynesian mythology and history, really. So and you know the most famous Polynesian on the planet is probably The Rock. You know The Rock, the actor. So anyways, so that I gave that context because New Zealand or Aotearoa, which is its in Maori name, was actually the last of these Polynesian places to be settled, mainly because we just so fucking far down in the bottom of the earth, basically. We're, you know, we're the largest land we're kind of the most southern largest land mass sitting in the middle of nowhere, basically. Or well, actually South America, maybe a little bit south, but anyway, we're in the middle of fucking nowhere. So the Maori found us about the 12th, 13th century, something like that. So they had been in New Zealand for about 400 or 500 years before Europeans arrived. And apparently by the time Europeans arrived, there was something like 200,000 Maori living in New Zealand, spread out around the country. And so the belief systems and customs that they had were very much part of this Polynesian culture, but it evolved and developed in its own way due to that, you know, 400 or 500 years of its own isolation. So I wanted to give that context around Maori being part of this greater group of people, because they share a lot of similar mythology and things like that, like Hawaii and Hawaiians and Maori, you know, share a huge amount of mythology together. So, you know, there's this really quite old context that and culture that they've got that fuses and feeds Maori. But what happened is when at the end of the 18th, it was in the 1700s, New Zealand was first discovered by a Dutch explorer, a guy named Abel Tasman, and hence why we're called New Zealand, because Zeeland is a Dutch province, and so New Zealand was given a Dutch name, even though the man who's most responsible for the European knowledge, initial knowledge of New Zealand is James Cook, who's also famous for doing a lot of exploring around Australia, and who's held up in many English and European circles as a great explorer. And if you talk to many indigenous populations, they think he's a prize cunt. So, you know, but his name is synonymous with discovering New Zealand. He's circumnavigated it, but so New Zealand's it was only in the late 17th century, coming into the 19th century, that white people actually started to come to New Zealand. So we're, you know, in many ways we were one of the last places on the planet to be discovered by the Europeans, I think, just as the Maori were the last Polynesians to get here. So again, that just shows our isolation. But over the course of the 19th century, the Maori population absolutely plummeted to the point where there was, at one point, there was only 30 or 40,000 Maori left. And nowadays, there aren't many purebred Maori, where the interbreeding between Maori and European has been quite immense and intense. And so in the course of that period in that 19th century, a huge amount of Te Ao Māori, they call it, which is the Māori culture, was stripped from them. And, you know, the language was forcibly taken, the land was forcibly taken, even though in 1840 there was a treaty of what's called the Treaty of Waitangi, which was a signed treaty between the English Crown and the Māori, essentially saying that all Māori land, as it is in 1840, belongs to Māori, and the Crown and the English Crown can have land that is not settled or not used. But over the course of the next 100 years, that treaty was spat on and kicked on, and basically the Maori were dislocated from their land, like most indigenous cultures, right? So the journey over the last 50 or 60 years, really, probably, since I was born, which I was born in 1972. So since I was born, the journey for Maori has been this reclaiming of their culture. Their language was almost a dead language. Very few people spoke it. A lot of their old traditions were lost. You know, it was one of these things where they really suffered. But over the last 50 years, there's been this remarkable resurgence of Maori speaking, of the bringing back of the language and the culture, and immense pride in being Maori. But also, I think now there's immense pride in being even people non-Maori in New Zealand. There's immense pride, I think, I'm certainly uncovering in Maori culture itself. And so there's beginning to be a big adoption of many things Maori within the non-Maori of New Zealand. So I share that context because this rites of passage course that I went on started up about 10 years ago by a couple of men who I would say would be, one was in his early mid 40s, another one was late 30s, I think. And so they as part of this reconnection to Māori culture and wanting to re-inspire the younger generation, they created this 3-day, well, what I experienced as a 3-day, I think sometimes they do it as 5-day and 7-day retreat. They created these retreats around the idea of rites of passage for boys, for 13 and 14 year old boys, to give them a journey, to help them transition on that journey into, from boyhood into teenagehood and adulthood, but also to help them in their journey and in coming into being more Māori, or coming into understanding their culture as well. So it had this kind of double overlay, really. And so I started it about 10 years ago, and only in the last few years I've actually started to do these rites of passage retreats for men. And that's why I got the privilege to go on it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And the reason for bringing men into it is that we all go through periods of transformation or periods of change in our lives. And as an example, you know, I'm going through the transformation of separating from Evelyn, my wife, and that's a massive change, right? And there's and in traditional many Indigenous cultures, you know, these periods of transformation require or periods of life passage actually require honoring. They require a recognition of it. And that's what this retreat was all about, was about this idea of recognizing and honoring the transition from one stage to the next, but also as we'll talk about when we get into this, the, a whole lot of skills and knowledge that you can gain to help with that on that transition on the path. So yeah, so does that help kind of set the stage, and does that give you enough info about Māori and New Zealand history for us to continue there, Rich?
More than enough for me personally, mate. I'm chomping at the bit to get to the experience itself. Like, that was a really interesting that came out wrong. Like, that's like, I didn't know a lot of that, you know what I mean? It's you got me really curious about what the retreat was about, meaning honoring these transitions rather than saying these are the transitions that you should have, etc. So at least that's kind of what I heard. So I'm curious to know more. Yeah. And like, tell us how you felt when you got there, and maybe just share some of the experiences that you had.
Yeah, well, so just, well, on how did I feel when I got there? I felt, so I showed up, I arrived and showed up onto the marae. And so a marae is it's like the local, each tribe or village will have their own marae, right? And tribes might have many different marais. And a marae is, it's kind of like a meeting house, probably like a bit like a town hall, really. But if you can imagine, it's kind of like the beating heart of any Māori community, right? And so we got showed up onto this marae, and I haven't been on a marae in 20 or 30 years. Like, so I'm a fifth generation New Zealander, but one of the things I have to confess to is I knew fuck all about Māori culture, about anything. So when I showed up on the marae, you know, I literally felt like I was a newborn. Like it's like I just popped out into an entirely new world that was so unfamiliar. So I can't remember having many times in my life where I felt so ill-equipped for what I was engaging in. You know, I really had no idea what what I had signed up for at all. I knew it was some kind of rites of passage retreat, but that kind of is it. I didn't know we were going to be staying for the week, for the time. I didn't know. I didn't know whether I needed to bring a tent with me or not. Like I knew nothing, right? So, I showed up there, and we got welcomed on, and so we got welcomed on to the marae, the beautiful kind of greetings and everything, and then we kind of got into, and so coming into this next your question there about what are rites of passage, and one of the beautiful explanation that they gave was that rites of passage are these, it's a process of transitioning or going from one stage into the next. And how in Maori culture they use this image of life as being, it's like a staircase, you know, the image of a staircase, you know, moving up in steps. And what they talk about is that life is just a series of these steps, these passages and transformations. And what you do is you, whenever you go through a process of change, you have to start with a separation. So in this instance, the separation was a physical one, right? So we went from where we were living, and we went and camped out in the bush, and we went on a journey to get there, this 9-hour walk to get there, right? It starts with a separation, but the separation can also be, it doesn't just have to be a physical separation. It can be an emotional separation. It can be something, but it's this idea that you are stepping away from what is familiar, and you have to do that first, because the second stage in a rites of passage is transformation. So you create the separation, then you do the transformation, and then the final stage is the integration. And the idea is that you can't really fully engage in the next step. You can't engage in the next change until you've actually integrated the first step, the first process. And so, you know, you can, so actually what they're saying is you can go through reasonably rapid periods of change or rites of passage, or you can have these kind of monumental period, you know, rites which signal big changes, such as going from boyhood to manhood, or becoming married, as you said, is a massive rite of passage, right? So they've got this beautiful kind of image around that being what a rite of passage is it's a separation, transformation, and then integration, these three steps.
Mean, interesting.
How's
Like,
that sound?
yeah, I mean, those steps, like, not in that context, but in the context of some form of growth or change, don't seem radically new. But perhaps this is actually kind
No.
of where they've come from. Like, I'm not aware of where I've picked that up, but it makes perfect sense actually. So I'm keen to hear more about the. Did they go through examples? Did they take you through one? Like, what did the setup of this place look like? Were you around a fire the whole time? Were you kind of actually learning, going through physical experiences? Like, paint us a picture of what you actually
Yeah.
did.
I shall indeed. But just to speak to that piece, Rich, that you said about, you know, it doesn't sound new, or I mean, it's because it's not, right? I mean, this is ancient stuff, and I think the one of the points that they made was that, you know, we're doing this all the time, and we're engaged in all this stuff. But what the idea here is that it's creating, you know, ceremony around it, which bring more attention to it. So rather than it just being, you know, something we fumble and bumble our way through, and maybe go and do a, you know, maybe we'll go out on you know, have our first night out on the piss or something, right? And that's your rite of passage into adulthood. Like this, it's ceremony and stuff. So I think that's where the piece that is the beautiful piece. But so yeah, I mean, in terms of what did we do? So the whole process was a rite of passage, in that the first day was about this idea of creating separation. And so what we did was, after lunch, we left the marae, and I mentioned we went on this 9-hour walk. So there's a There's a tradition in New Zealand called a hīkoi, which is a long march, but it's a long march with purpose. And so what we did is we were walking, but we weren't just walking in a direction. We were actually walking and talking, and we would every few hundred meters we started on the beach and then went into the bush. But we spent about 3 or 4 hours walking along the beach because we'd walk a few hundred meters and with a partner discussing particular things, particular ideas, particular concepts, right? And so for the first part of the walk, what we did is we discussed what they call the six what are they called? The six childhood experiences. So it's this idea that in childhood, all kids have these experiences about life. An example of one of them is that I am the center of the universe, right? So that's like a childhood experience. Another one is I am my emotions, right? So it's this idea that as kids, we just our emotions flow freely through us, and we rant and we laugh and we do all that kind of stuff. And so, and in this first part of the thing, what we did is we explored these six childhood experiences. But what we were doing is we were saying, well, how were we, what you know what do we think of these experiences, but are we still experiencing them now, or where in our life are we still experiencing them? And I tell you what, that was a real interesting thing to do, because what I take this one about I am the center of the universe. Yeah, fuck yeah, that still rules, that still inhabits my life. And so the question was, well, what's the cost of that? Well, it creates me quite a bit of emotional torture, because when I don't get my way, I get really fucking upset, right? So the idea of doing that was that if you're thinking about this idea of growth and transition, it's like, where have we not? The intention with this discussion was, where have you not transitioned from childhood? Where are you still stuck in your childhood? And man, that was a really powerful thing to explore as we were walking along the beach. And so we did that, and then we transitioned into teenagehood, right? And we did a kind of a similar thing, just but looking at, what are our good memories about being a teenager, and what are our shit memories of being a teenager, and how are those still impacting us today? Like, again, it's this idea of where have we not transitioned into adulthood? Where are we still stuck? And we basically spent the whole 9 hours exploring this part as we were walking along the beach and in the bush. And the idea, so we've got this physical separation, but what we're also trying to do is create some separation. What they were trying to do was, I think, I have to ask them again, but to create some separation from these childhood and teenage experiences. As adult men, what do we need to do in order to begin to leave that stuff behind that is no longer serving us, and how can we kind of step more fully into adulthood, holding and maintaining, like some of the stuff from being kids, that you're the energy and all that. Like, what do you want to hold on to, and what do you need to discard? Those kind of questions. And I mean, how fuck me, that was a remarkably powerful experience, just to walk and share. And it's that whole thing of moving and moving through the environment, and to explore this, and as we went from the beach into the bush, it was kind of, we went from these wide open expanses into these closed in jungle like trails that we were walking through. And just the energetic shift and the change and the inward journey that it made, that it felt kind of going into the bush, it was like kind of entering into this pathway. And as we walked through that, the sun went down and it got dark, so we're having to walk through the bush and out with our headlamps in it. And it just had this really visceral experience of coming into an unknown place, and until we arrived late at night in this around to this fireplace, this big fireplace, and which was where we made camp, which was where we were going to camp for the next 2 nights. So the whole thing was 3 days, 2 nights, the retreat, which in mythological terms is quite a significant number. Apparently transformation occurs over 2 days, 3 nights, or 3 days, 3 nights, apparently is the rule of thumb. But anyway, so that was the first day, was this journey through our past so that we could arrive. It was like when we arrived at the campfire, we were arriving into the present. And I think they may even have described that. It's like you are now arriving here as a man into this place. And just because of that journey, it was, I mean, I can feel it in me now. I'm getting the tingles of what it was like to arrive into that fire and to be around it and to be kind of coming really clear about this idea of just stepping into this, into the present, into this place here, where it was like at that was the point at which I could start to step into the transformation.
Man, you've said so much, and it's only kind of day one. Like, I mean, just to kind of double back on some of these pieces, like this piece around ceremony that you mentioned really stood out to me. The separation, transformation, integration is kind of something that we've learned to do, I think, you know, on these kinds of retreats. That's kind of partly why it sprung to mind, because it's what we try and do on the men's retreat in Denmark. And yet it's not something that we do in daily life when we think about going through periods of change, right? So it's really kind of a limited to, I would say, kind of a personal growth sort of era, you know, or area, excuse me. But the piece that is settling, that's more useful, I think, to me, and to men especially, is this idea of honoring ceremony, you know, like really taking a moment. Like, we're not just going from a walk from A to B and you know, listen to some music. It's like, hey, this is a process, and actually being in that state, being in that stage, and being around other people, there's a sense of like, okay, well, it's about definition and meaning to me. It's almost like you know, if we define like this, you know, when you walk into a new house that you might consider moving into, and you, someone says that, you know, some celebrity used to live here and great things happened, you go, ooh. And versus, you know, like, yeah, this used to be a piggery or a butcher, and you're like, okay. So it's like,
yeah,
like the definition you give something. And again, we do this unconsciously, but this conscious act of honoring a process or a stage of life or growth, and really calling your attention to that. And it's like, I've seen that with men. And I think as humans, women, more and more on Instagram now, the less time I spend on it, the better, I think. But the more and more, like, every woman in the sort of personal spiritual growth space that has a baby feels like they've got to share this whole process. And part of me is like, ugh. But actually I get what they're doing. They're honoring these different sort of stages of the birth, as opposed to it being a 9-month struggle and thunk, it's out. It's like, well, no. There's something quite powerful happening. It can go overboard, of course, but like, there's something about honoring these processes that, and I think there's part of me is going, you know, ceremony can feel a bit like cultural appropriation at times. You don't really know what we're doing with it, but when it feels like you've been initiated into it, you know, it was kind of, and there was a, I picked up a sense of awe in you and kind of humility. And I think these are key fucking words that means you're stepping out of the space of child into adulthood. There's a big sort of ego piece, which you called attention to earlier. I'm getting quite excited now, but that awe and humility of like, okay, there's something bigger going on than just these first couple of stages that you mentioned, like my emotions and I'm the center of the universe. And we've known about this clearly, or at least this culture has, for so long, you know, and yet I guess I'm lamenting that we've really lost that. And it's kind of limited to the spiritual realms in personal development for people to kind of bring this back in. And it's like, how can we bring it in more? You know what I mean? Cause what you're describing to me is really powerful.
Yeah. Well, it is, and it's also, well, the other way that we deal with it is we put it in psychological terms, right? And we, as if it's kind of Which usually the moment we do that, we always put it in dysfunction, it becomes dysfunctional. And whereas this
How
is
do you
just
mean?
very much about,
How do you mean? I've
well,
got
it's
my
like,
boxing gloves up for psychology here because I'm really into that. So, what do you mean?
well, what I mean by that is that so this piece around, okay, let's just take I am my emotions, right? And so one of the journeys into adulthood is learning how to experience emotions, control them, etc., right? But if we're not, you can go to a psychologist and it becomes a, although I'm not trying to belittle it all because I'm also seeing a psychologist, I think it's brilliant. But what I mean by this is that we tend to give them a label of something that maybe it's dysfunctional inside of us, and we just want to sort it out. Whereas what I got from this process was that it's a journey, right? That it's a life journey, and it's a life passage. And some of these things we've integrated when we're in part of the journey. Some of these things, like another one was, it was around competition. It's like I am the boss, and everybody is competition. Like that's a childhood experience, right? And I'm like, actually, I've integrated that one. I don't have any of that. I don't feel like I have any of that showing up in me as an adult, but I know I have, particularly the stuff around being the center of the universe. That shows up in me an adult, but it's not that it's dysfunctional. It's just that I haven't actually had an opportunity to integrate it. Or what they would say, what I get that they get from this rites of passage is that we were never actually taught how to come into adulthood and leave that behind. You know what I mean? So it doesn't be, it's not anything actually that it's not an issue. It's just something, it's just a missing experience that we just need to actually, you can, all right, go and do a rites of passage and you can pretty much integrate it, right? And interestingly enough, I think actually there's a huge amount that is true in that. Actually, by just going back and doing that process, fuck me, have I had an opening and awakening to integrating those parts of my childhood into who I am now. I think even just doing the ceremony around it creates an integration and creates an integrative experience. Feels so positive, rather than thinking about it as a thing that I need to sort out or a dysfunction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think you're sort of conveying like the impact of like an experience like that, which is something that because we don't have, we don't do, we can't automatically relate to, we don't understand its power, you know. And the you know, I went to one, and I won't go into the details because it's a separate thing, but it's about the Father and the Son and Jesus Christ, you know, essentially sort of burying your father, lighting a candle, and then kind of saying some words into a fire, long story short. But when you've got a bunch of men around that and the context that's been set, there's been it's a ceremonial process. And like, yeah, that I wonder how many hours of psychotherapy that could have saved. I mean, I'm not claiming that one's better than the other. I think probably what we're coming to, is is both, you know, this piece of an integration, like maybe that can be done more effectively, or it's a both and approach. That's going to be my assumption, but not to steer you away from what we're actually talking about. I just love that idea of ceremony, and thank you for clarifying what you mean by that. It makes sense.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. Both and all the way through this whole experience, I think it's for me, the piece was, what do we have to learn? And in this instance, it was like, what do we have to learn from the Maori perspective, from Maori culture? What do we have to learn? What are the gifts that we have to add to who we are as human beings that can enrich us? I mean, they've got, one of the So I've used the term te ao Māori. So one of the key underpinnings within which I didn't really understand or grasp, but it is a very indigenous, universally indigenous way of living in the world, is this idea of is the relationship between nature and people. And throughout the entire 3 days, that was the massive, that was kind of like the foundation from which everything was built upon, this idea that this unified experience of people and nature, and but nature not also not just being the physical nature, but the spirit of it all as well, that infuses everything. And so the sense of spirit and connectedness was just so powerful in the whole experience, in a way that wasn't, like, to quote or poorly, a lot of what I hear out in the world, now about modern spirituality, this idea of we are all one, right? And it's like we're all one and all this kind of stuff. But to authentically feel or experience people, a culture that where that is its identity, it actually is a part of, when they talk about the relationship with their land, what that actually means is that the land is their identity. The land is their soul. The land is who and what they are, right? Where it's not something you own. Like, these all con I mean, this was a concept, of course, that I hear all many indigenous cultures talk about, but on this was the very first time I got to actually, in my soul, understand what that means for somebody who for whom that is what their culture has brought them up to be. And I mean, God, man, it's so powerful. And I just, in that moment, I'm like, this is, it was like, this is the lesson. This is why I get now why they say, when, if we want to save the planet, we need to listen to the indigenous people who live in it, who, because when you feel the land, which is what they do, when the land is a part of you, you can hear it cry, right? And that was their experience that I got from these guys, was that, they heard they could feel the love, and they could feel the hurt in the land, and it just was infused. And so when the Māori were stripped of their land 150 years ago, it's not just having their land taken from them, it's having the essence of who they are taken from them. And again, that to learn that in such a profound, to actually experience that for me in a profound way, to witness what the relationship with the land and what it means to have that stripped away from the Māori, because that was actually a big piece of what we talked about on the second day, was we got into, there was quite a big piece that they did around, because you have to remember that this retreat is, it's normally predominantly Māori who go on this retreat. It's for Māori. It's not for Pākehās to come along and learn about Māori. It's for Māori. I was fortunate enough that there were some spare spaces, and actually on this retreat there were a number of non-Māori on it. But so, a big part of this this retreat is the healing of the wounds of the past from being separated from their land. And so they did this big piece around everything that was, all the land reform acts, all the parliamentary laws that were passed that were basically stripped the Māori of their connection to their land. And so that was all, they reenacted it over the course of about an hour. They reenacted all of these laws that were passed against the Māori, and I was sitting in this circle around the fire and visibly watching all these Maori men just kind of shrink and just the absolute broken heartedness of it all, of experiencing these men around and what the impact of those laws had on them, on their families, on their history, on who they are today, even though it happened, you could say it happened 100, 150 years ago, you know, the weight of it still to this day. And, you know, to sit and feel that was an experience that I'll never forget. And I get tears in my eye. I'll never forget it, Rich. And I'll never forget the shame that I felt sitting there, not because I'm responsible for any of that, but the shame I felt was because of my indifference. You know, I hadn't ever taken any time to connect and to really, yes, I got that there was pain and horror. I got it intellectually. And the shame was that I'd never taken time to really understand what it meant for the people for whom I'm whose land my ancestors came and took away from them, you know. And
I have a question around that, actually.
Yeah,
because there's in different ways, some graceful, some not. There is a general calling for people to look into, you know, and take responsibility for in some way. You know, these kind of how to label it, you know, like the indigenous kind of crushing and the culture that's been kind of taken over, and it's happened, you know, all over the world. You've tapped into something, and I'm really keen to understand, like, beyond the shame, which is a kind of an important and healthy emotion, right? Like, I'm glad you experienced that. I'm glad that you can share that and move me and no doubt other people. But, like, fundamentally, what has this given you, this particular experience that you'll never lose? Like, what do you see differently? How do you feel? How do you behave towards yourself, other people, perhaps the Maori? I'm really keen to understand more about that.
Well, I think, I mean, the big shift to me is in my, in my relationship with Maori, in that, I mean, so partly learning about this historical, and you know, failing of justice or injustice, whatever you want to call it, but I think this whole process has made me, has really helped me see the richness of Māoridom, of the you know, what I've been fed for 50 years of my life, a particular worldview that's a European worldview, looking at the Maori and I'll call it what it is, a pretty fucking racist perspective, right? A viewpoint that is focused on the negative sides of things, such as, you know, whether it's violence or, you know, as with a lot of indigenous cultures, there's a problem with booze, there's a problem with obesity, you know, there's all those kind of you know, those things that have occurred that are within the Maori community. And you know, in New Zealand, the Maori, there's a huge disproportionate amount of Maori men in jail. Maori don't live anywhere near as long as white people, you know, all these things, right? That's the picture. And you know, and there's a lot of blame and finger pointing that get put on Maori about that. It's like, it's your fault, you know. And what has happened is it's just completely blown that out of the water for me. One, it's like understanding the historical injustice and what it mean and what it's meant for them to be ripped from the land. Yeah, I mean, fuck, it takes, I can understand why it takes generations to heal that and why you may never, why it's so hard to. But also the other thing is just to recognize just how rich their culture was before and still is. That is, and what, and when I say that, it's like, the complexity of their social the social ideas and constructs. Like, for example, one of the things that we spend quite a lot of time talking about is it's like, this is my language because I can't quite remember actually what they called it, but it's like in Maori society, they've kind of got these nine pillars, right? Nine pillars that make the, and they're a lot like yoga's eight, what are the eight
Eightfold Path,
limbs of your,
eight
eightfold, eight
limbs of it.
limbs of yoga. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of like the eight, like, so you've got, the top three are, they have this term called Moody, which is like the, which is like exactly like chi. It's the essence of life, right? The spark of life, the vibration of life. So they've got that. They, that's one pillar, understanding that. The second one is this idea of mana, which is, everybody is born with, every body is born with mana, which is this innate respect that you have, that you deserve as a human being. And it flows through all of us. And so when you meet another person, you're not just meeting that person, you're meeting their mana, their, this essence of who they are as a person. But there's also a universal mana. There's like this universe, this spiritual essence that flows through everything as well, which is a bit different from Māori, but it has this, it's got this kind of power and respect that you give it. And then there's another part of the thing, another one of these pillars, which is called tapu, which is the sacredness of life. It's like, and they talk about, there's good tapu and there's bad tapu, right? And you don't, so area of like places, locations are tapu, are considered to be sacred, and you treat them with respect, and practice. Practices are considered sacred. So they've got this, so they're three, they're like three pillars, right? And then, and they're kind of in the spiritual, ethereal realm, but then you kind of come down into cultural realm, and then there are the, and there are these pillars around how societies interact and the respect that you show each other. And there's also this, one of the pillar is the pillar of the mind, your thoughts. Another pillar is the pillar of your heart, and that your heart is the center that drives decisions are made in the heart. They're not made in the head, like that's one of the one of the social constructs, and it's just, which is just so beautiful, right? So there's this, it's just this, when I, so when I talk about there's this richness that I've discovered, it's like that's what I mean. It's like there's so, there's this fullness, if you like, on the way that they lived, which again has carried over to so many different cultures around the world. This, everything has a, everything has a purpose, everything has a meaning. Like even their language, like the way that they put words together. So the word for love, I love this, right? The word for love is aroha. And that breaks down into two parts. There's aro, which means, which is that the mind is the seat of our feelings, right? And ha is breath. So when you, or that, what, or what, it's like the breath of life. It's the essence of the essence of life, ha. So aroha means to bring your mind and your feelings and your breath to someone else. It's like you're bringing the essence of your life to someone else. And I, and all of a sudden, aroha, had the word aroha, which I'd always interpreted as just, oh, it's love. Actually, all of a sudden, I'm like, holy fuck, it's got this massive kind of full, rich. And I could have got that wrong. But that's how I've interpreted it since I've come back and had a look at it. But that's what I mean by just learning, being in the presence of this and getting to see just how expansive their culture is and how much there is to gold to be learned from it.
Wow. I mean, there's so much you've shared there, like over the course of this podcast. I feel like, I mean, we've spoken less about rites of passage and I've learned more about just kind of the Maori themselves and kind of the impact that they've had for sure on you, but like historically, the way they've come from, now some of their approaches that they're clearly like a such a rich, beautiful culture. And you know, I get the beauty of that that's coming through from what you're saying, as well as the there's a constriction in me and my breath as I refer to the what happened to them, like the experience of, and then the shame that you felt around that. That there's a what a story. Like, I mean, I'm conscious of time slightly as well, just because of my own limitations on this. And I'm wondering, like, how much more in terms of what you wanted to share about the experience, the rites of passage themselves. Is there another podcast in there? Like, how would you kind of want to share more?
Well, possibly. I mean, how much time? We should have had this discussion beforehand, Rich. How much time do you have, mate?
I've got about
Have you
another
got, because
10
I
minutes.
what I was gonna, yeah, okay. Well, let me just rip into the rites, the actual kind of a little bit about the rites of passage, because again, it's as much the ceremony, and the thing that I got about it is that it's often not so much, it's not what you do, it's the kind of the emphasis and the sacredness, that's the word I was looking for, the sacredness almost that you give it. So in this instance, what we did on day two is we learned how to light fire, and the idea being is that lighting fire is, that's like, it's the essence of life. Without fire, we aren't who we are. We aren't the being that we are, right? And so that there's a sacredness to fire. So we all learned how to light fire on our own, and then through the entire course, the rest of the time, we had to keep that fire alive. So whether it rained a couple of times through the night, we had to, a couple of guys had to sleep by the fire and stoke it all night long. So, again, so there's a sacredness to the practice of the fire. So learning how to do the fire, keeping it alive. And so day two and coming into day three was going through this process of transformation. So it was kind of, in a way, it was exploring what was our own personal transformation that we were wanting to go under. So this journey of learning about Maori history and its nine pillars and everything was really opening the door, I think, to us coming into what are we being called to transform. And on the second night, as part of that journey, we were taken out into the bush and just left in the bush. There was no moon, and turned our lights off, and we were just left to sit there in silence. And I know that there's lots of different places that go off and do that, and retreats and teenage things that I know the Outward Bounds in New Zealand, they go and drop their kids off for a night in the bush, and they have to fend for themselves. So it was a little bit like that, but it was only for an hour or two. But it was just the process of, in that pitch dark stillness in the middle of the bush with just the owls and everything around us, it's like, what comes up? And that is the moment for a number of men where in a way, the transformation occurred, or the transformation begun. And I think for me, that's where it began, was in that moment of silence. What I could feel the stirring inside me, and I was like, my body was beginning to bubble. And it was in the next day when I kind of hit what my transformation was. And it was when we were doing this piece around, we actually did this really beautiful piece around sex, gender, and identity, and how, you know, in Western culture, we box everything. So gender we box, sex we box families. You know, a family is a mum, dad, and kids. That's in a box. You know, and even, you know, transgender, you're in a box, right? Everything gets boxed. Whereas what they would say, you know, in the Maori Polynesian worldview is that everything is just on a continuum. And this will resonate with you, Rich, that this whole masculine feminine thing, you know, that left side of the body, right side of the body, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, one of the guys who was guiding it, he's just said, you know, my masculine feminine side changes daily. It jumps from left side to right side. It's back and forth. It asks me to do different things. He's like, it doesn't. It's not stable and stationary. And it just was so cool to hear it, because it made me realize just how much, you know, in my teaching, when I learned all my body work, and everybody, you know, they talked about the right side of the brain, the left side of the body is the feminine, and the left side of the brain, right side of the body is the masculine. And this guy's, well, no, it's just bullshit. That's just labels, right? It's all, it's where, what, how is it, how is it expressing itself through me in this moment? And I think that was the big piece. It's like, how is this stuff, you know, what is expressing in me in my life at this moment? And take the box away and allow that to be expressed. Because one of the beautiful things about Polynesian culture is that there is this wide acceptance of men, boys being raised as girls. That happens in many, many families. I won't get into that, but that's just a big thing, right? And it was in that process of exploring that what I realized was that the emphasis on the heart was on about this idea of we connect to each other through our hearts, we relate through our hearts, we see each other through our hearts. And I just, in the moment, I realized that was my transformation. It was that I realized that I had been my wife, woman, men, I'd kind of, it was as if I'd been relating to them through my cock, you know, through this identity as a man, through this driven by my cock. And actually the transformation was, for me, was about seeing people through my heart, connecting to people through my heart. And that, and it was just like this fucking whoosh. It hit me, you know, that's what I was there to transform. And so in that moment, I think over the course of the 2 days that we had there, each man kind of had their own insight into whatever their transformation was. And then the final anchoring of that transformation was we then walked away and we did this process where we covered ourselves in mud, with the mud representing all of our many faces and identities and everything else. And we then went into the river and just washed all those away. And again, it's the sacredness of the journey, right? The metaphor around it. So it was just the power of, you know, and washing all those identities away that were stopping us from stepping into this transformative path, right? There's a journey. So, you know, I mean, in some ways it's, you know, the passage, it probably isn't that different from a number of, you know, the content or what we're doing is not that different. But there's something, I think what rites of passage are about is it's is it are the it's the rituals and the sacredness of the things that you do that carry the power and the weight, and that's what leads to the recognition of the importance of and the power of the change. And it's also what I think leads to the change being a permanent change rather than a temporary experience that you then forget about the moment you walk away from it.
Amen to that, brother. That's a really nice really nice way to round up the description piece. Yeah, man, that and that feels that landed in my body as well. Thank you, brother.
So yeah, Rich, it just speaks to the stuff that you and I do, the power of bringing ritual and things into it a bit more and what that has to offer. And I know that you do, but it's just such a powerful thing to experience.
Just to open up a whole other topic, but I'm aware of what I can lead and facilitate based on the experiences that I've had and been taken through. But that's as far as one can, I believe, kind of teach from. And what you experienced and what the cultural and historical weight that it was being carried down and passed through sounds way more powerful. You know what I mean? It's like I would want to truly experience that to have a hope to kind of transmit a particle of that. You know, it sounds profound, and I'm just, you know, there's us kind of, for want of a better phrase, kind of white men throwing the stuff out there that is useful and impactful. I've seen it, I've felt it. And there's listening to those that have it's been passed down to them, no doubt, and with the weight and the experience that that they can what's the word I'm looking for, kind of transmit, or you know what I mean, just kind of carry across, like the depth of it. Your experience has really kind of come through, and I'm just I'd be keen, very keen, and I sort of humbly with trepidation step towards something like that. It doesn't sound like, it sounds like a chilled out weekend, you know, throw some beers in the back. It's like, go with that impression at your peril, I would say. And it sounds incredible.
Yeah. And there was also one of the beautiful things that one of the elder on the Marae who welcomed us on, he did say, you know, go and have the journey and do it with a light heart. You know, and that I just
rich tattoos on arm.
Go with light heart, like, you know, also don't take it too seriously, you know. And which I think was a good reminder for certainly for, you know, the Protestant Catholic bloody self-loathing beating up culture that we come from, it's good to be reminded at times, you know, go with a light heart. And if there's one thing that I also got, you know, spending time in the group with many Māori men is the laughter too, right? Lots of laughter is alongside all of that. So, you know, how laughter, the medicine of laughter, along, you know, as a way of healing the pain, right? Powerful.
Yeah, let's not forget that. That's a perfect reminder. I mean, that hasn't been sort of talked about as much, but that balances out any experience, right? And I love that he mentioned that lighthearted piece. That's, like, as I said, that's something for me to tattoo on my forehead.
Make sure you do it backwards so you can see it in the mirror, Rich.
No, it's for other people to remind me. I'm not responsible for.
Nice.
And on that lighthearted note, my good friend, exactly. I'll invite us to wrap it up here and just say, you've definitely given me a detailed and really clear sense of what you experienced, and I'm really grateful. Anyone out there listening, I hope that some of that landed. I'm curious to know what you heard. You know, like, as ever, we are engageable, and we're really open to kind of hearing what part of that landed for you. And if you're curious to hear us talk to other people and explore more of these aspects, then please reach out. It's been enlightening for me, for sure.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say that I've done my best to Try to recreate the experience. I hope I recognize I probably got some things wrong within my Māori pronunciation, but also in the way that in some of my attempt at describing facts and everything. So I apologize if it wasn't perfect. I hope hope I haven't offended anybody. If any is anybody is Māori on this listening to this podcast, and I butchered some things. I sincerely apologize if that's the case. And with that, I'll say good night, Rich.
Literally, you shut the laptop down and snuggle up, mate. Big hug to
Exactly.
you. Thanks to everyone for listening. Speak to you all, or talk to you all again soon. Ciao for now.
Absolutely. Ciao.